Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
And you know, when I talk with people who have studied with the best, the issue is, are you committed to change? Hi there, I am Carol Jurgensen-Sheets, and I'm here to talk to you about sexual addiction. I've made it my mission to talk about this disorder and how it affects the person, people that you love, your families, and what you can do to get on track so that you actually become the best person you could ever be. And I know it may feel like that's impossible today, but I guarantee you, if you work a strong recovery program, you can not only learn how to manage this addiction and no longer be chained by the addiction, but you can actually be better than you ever believed anybody could have ever thought that you would have been. Now, how does that happen? Well, the beautiful thing about addiction is that when you work a program and you work the recovery steps, you actually not only heal the wounds, which is imperative to getting through addiction and growing stronger, but you develop coping skills and living skills that are healthier than if you did nothing. So if I lined up 1,000 people who were relatively healthy, but they did nothing towards self-improvement, you, the addict in recovery, working a strong recovery program, would be healthier than them. That is the good news. And I know it may feel hard to believe right now in your own life, but I promise you, and the 12 steps promises you that you can lose the craving and the urges and work towards self-discovery of who you are and continue to better your own life. So I want you to believe me. I wouldn't be telling you this if it weren't true. And I want you to stay tuned to the show because every week we interview experts, experts in the field of sexual addiction. Tonight I'm going to be interviewing Deborah Schweiger-Whalen, who I am so excited about. She's actually going to be my roommate at the next ITAP symposium. And Deborah has a lot of different specialties, but she has made it her mission to work with sexual addiction and eating disorders. And so she's written papers, she's created programming, and she wants to talk about the overlap between eating disorders and sexual addiction. Now, I know if you're listening to the show and you're like, well, this show doesn't apply to me. I don't have an eating disorder. That very well could be true. But I guarantee you there is more than likely something that you can substitute the eating disorder with. Maybe you spend too much. Maybe you smoke too much. Maybe you drink too much. Maybe you do drugs. You see, what we've learned about the addiction of sexual addiction is that it typically fuses with at least one, if not more, addictions, and it takes hold of you. And maybe one addiction starts the second addiction, and it's a precursor for the third addiction. Or maybe you fuse them all together. But as you listen to Deborah, I want you to imagine what other issues in your life feel out of control that you would like to curb. And if eating is one of them, I totally understand. Now, if you've been listening to the show, you know that I am married to a man who has recovered from alcoholism for the last 20 years. What do I mean by that? It doesn't mean that alcoholism is gone. It means that he's learned how to manage it. And February 23rd of this year, it will have been 20 years. Now, the interesting thing is, if you looked at the guy, I didn't know him back then, but he was stick thin. And one of the things we know is that when you give up one addiction, another addiction or issue, out-of-control behavior may occur. So my husband is a gorgeous man, but he actually is probably 30, 40 pounds overweight. And food has become his life. He is a foodie. He loves food. You know, when I took him out for his 10th anniversary, I said, honey, you can have whatever you want to eat. We are at the finest restaurant. You just order whatever you want off the menu. Well, the first thing he did was he ordered an $80 appetizer. Now, guys, I might be a bit decadent, but $80 for an appetizer? Well, I had to bite my tongue. We were celebrating something super important, but I'm here to tell you that is not how I would choose to normally spend my money. $80 on an appetizer? Now get this. It was a seafood platter. Here's the bitch about this. I don't even like seafood. Well, I mean, I like shrimp, but I don't like crab. I don't like clams. I don't like lobster. I can't even remember what was on there. But I did tell him, you order whatever you want. And he knew that we were celebrating something important, and it mattered not. He got that appetizer. I knew we were in for a heck of a bill by the end of the night. But, you know, when somebody has curtailed a behavior that is negative, that is self-defeating, that is destructive, and they've worked a program that allows them to lose the urges and the cravings, I say let's celebrate. Well, I'm lucky enough to still be with this guy 10 years later, and it will be his 20th anniversary this month. So I'll report back to you and let you know how much in the poorhouse we are, because, of course, I'm going to buy him another fabulous dinner, and I'm going to tell him you get whatever you want, even though the sticker price is going to be making me go, oh, my gosh, did I really say that? I can't emphasize enough how proud I am of somebody who takes control and makes the decision to make their life better. You know, I got an email from a listener, and he sent me his daily recovery plan. And actually, it was written on. I mean, he sent it to me, and he talked about some issues that he had that I know Deb is going to be able to help him with today because it included overeating. As a matter of fact, he was part of OA, which is Overeaters Anonymous. So I can't thank him enough. I said, hey, would you send me a blank copy so I can pass this on to my clients? And here is an example of his daily plan. You know, I have told you that it's so important for you to have structure set up every single day. And his recovery focus included the following: daily meditations. He does the 40 and 90 day focus in Patrick Carn's book. He does recovery reading. He journals daily and has a gratitude list. Wow. He has at least 5 affirmations that he works on saying to himself every day. He has 30 minutes of meditation and prayer. He attends a 12-step meeting. He has contact with his therapist and or his sponsor, or as he calls it, his recovery posse. He has contact with at least 3 peers. He exercises 1 hour daily, typically yoga. He has an OA sponsor, and so he emails his food list to his OA sponsor. He connects with his children. He works on learning something new, something fun, and he identifies his feelings every day. And for him, his feelings include the 9. Now remember, I have the famous primary feelings 5, but his are, and this looks like it came straight out of a treatment program: anger, fear, guilt, joy, loneliness, love, pain, passion, and shame. Okay. So he does that every single day, and he identifies what he's followed through with and what he has not. So at least he's aware if there are 8 zeros in a row regarding meditation or prayer, he knows to get started on that. Then in addition to that, he has a personal craziness index. Now, a personal craziness index came from Patrick Carn's work. If you've ever read Facing the Shadows, the workbook and book, it talks about if your life is out of control, your bedroom's probably a mess, your workplace is probably lacking in organization, you've run out of time to spend with the wife or the kids to make the calls you need to. And so he has that it is important for him to put together things that absolutely make up a healthy daily recovery program. And they have nothing to do with recovery. They have to do with sanity in his everyday life. Now, his list would include praying, and he does so on his knees every morning or night, returning calls within 24 hours, brushing and flossing his teeth for at least 2 minutes, keeping his clothes organized. He takes some charge of his life if he is having difficulty with honesty, if he has trouble calming himself down, if he drives unsafely, doesn't put on a seatbelt, and looks at other indicators where his life is disorganized or unsafe. You know, if you ride without your seatbelt, speed, get into work late, stay up late, put the kids off, your life is more than likely unmanageable, and that will lead to a slip or relapse. So when he is charting what he's doing in a positive way, he's also looking for indicators that his life may be out of control in other ways. And I so appreciate him sharing this list with me. Now, the last thing he has on his list, and again, I really admire this, is he has a check-in with his wife every day. He spends time just being with her physically. They make some sort of physical contact. You know, I tell my couples, if you're going to argue with your partner, I want you two to be touching each other, at least knees to knees, and if possible, grab each other's hands. He works consistently on nurturing his wife, focusing on her sexual needs, and talking about what would make them closer. So that is the third part of his daily plan for recovery. So if you're wondering what you can do to manage your sexual recovery, to manage your sexual addiction, I've just given you a great example of somebody who walks his talk and charts every single day what he's doing. And when you do that, then you set up the proper infrastructure to make your life healthier and happier. You feel more in control. And when that happens, you're more likely to follow your entire recovery plan. And I'm so glad he goes to OA. I'm hoping he's listening tonight because Deborah has got a lot of wisdom to share. So I want to welcome you to the show, Deborah. Welcome to Sex Help with Carol the Coach.
Hi, Carol. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, absolutely. It appears that you have really made it your mission to help people with sexual addiction and typically that fusing that they may have with overeating. So I thought maybe we could talk about that tonight.
Well, yeah, I, as a clinician, became very drawn to working with individuals with eating disorders, and time again was brought into contact with not just their eating behaviors, but also their sexual behaviors. And it's always felt very clear to me that these are very closely related behaviors that seem to run the same course, and that these behaviors seem to kind of duplicate each area, one another, and that these areas really, when looked at together, can be very powerful. And lots of times I've met with people who are either who have previously been in treatment for eating disorders or conversely for sexual addiction. And when I start asking questions about, you know, the other piece, they say kind of, you know, why are you asking me these questions? And I say, just trust me a little bit. I want to see if we can draw some parallels here. And a lot of times we do, and I find that when we talk about these behaviors, you know, at the same time, instead of treating one thing at a time, that people really make deep inroads into these behaviors.
Well, absolutely. That makes so much sense. Because one of the things we know is that when somebody has a sexual addiction, if they begin to recover from that, if they have other issues in their life, that may typically get worse. So I can imagine that if they're overeaters or if they starve themselves, that would perpetuate more problems. So I'm so glad that you talked to them about both of those things together. Now, tell me a little bit about, you've said, you actually wrote a paper and you said that it isn't possible to separate eating from sexuality. They're both process issues, are they not?
Right. That would be some of the language we use in our field, right? So it wouldn't be necessarily, you know, a substance like alcohol or heroin, but these are things that people do. I think I would try to conceptualize the way I work with people is that I'm very, very interested in what people are doing with their bodies. So eating, not eating, binging and purging, not having sex at all, having sex all the time with very few boundaries, or we see the kind of overlap in the area of binge and purge. Many of the people struggling with bulimia, food bulimia, or exercise bulimia that I've worked with, also their sexual lives seem to take on this binge and purge cycle. So maybe lots and lots of sex that they don't feel so great about, and then periods of abstinence where they kind of want to purge themselves of it. So those are the kinds of things that we see. And I know earlier in the show you were talking about your husband and gaining weight as he went into recovery. That is something that goes on so frequently and probably does not get enough attention, just as, you know, the language around 13-stepping. People go into drug, alcohol recovery and are working a strong program, and all of a sudden we have some sexual behavior flaring up that wasn't there before. So, yes, there is this, you know, there's the fused addiction that you were talking about where things are happening simultaneously, and one kind of is contingent upon the other. And then sometimes we do see when somebody stops drinking wine every night, they're now binging and purging with food, whereas before it was maybe once a month or every 2 months, but now they're doing it much more regularly. So these kinds of behaviors, you know, they can be fused or they can sneak up when people are in recovery for something else. So, you know, as Patrick Carnes has taught us, it's so much, we're all so much better off when we look at all of these issues at the same time instead of piecemeal.
So then, you know, obviously in the article that you wrote, on eating behaviors, eating disorders, and sexual addiction, you said that eating behaviors and sexual behaviors often run on parallel tracks. So what kinds of patterns have you seen with your clients in regards to this?
Well, I've been very grateful to Patrick Carnes for his attention, for the focus on sexual anorexia, because pretty much across the board, when working with a client with food anorexia, I once had a supervisor who said to me, when you're working with somebody who's anorexic, you want to look for the anorexia all throughout their lives. So, for example, when I'm working with somebody who is restricting food to the point where it's having a deleterious effect on their health, their well-being, their brain functioning, because after all, we need to feed our brains. I really want to know everything about their lives. Do they shop for themselves? Do they have furniture in their house? Do they have clothes? All of these things. And, of course, not 100% of the time, but, Carol, most of the time, this inability to respond to basic needs, the need response is kind of anorexic. So people just don't have enough of what they need, and not just with food. And what I have seen and what we know very often about food anorexics is that there is this very strong difficulty with sexuality, with the sexual development of the self, with sexual contact with others. And the article that I sent to you starts out with a conversation I had with a young woman who spent many, many years in treatment, and she had seen a presentation I did on this issue at a conference. And she came up to me and said, I've been in 3 different treatment centers, and nobody has ever asked me about my sexual behavior. And I thought that was really quite astounding, because I think what I have found just anecdotally in my work is that if somebody isn't eating enough and they're afraid of food, they're often afraid of contact with other people, with their own sexuality, and with the sexuality of others. And I really, again, appreciate Patrick Carnes, because he really has drawn attention to not just sexual compulsivity and addiction, but he has looked at sexual anorexia, which is very, very real. And we often see that in food anorexics.
So that makes total sense. Can you describe what sexual anorexia is to people that may never have heard of that terminology?
Sure. So essentially, when we're working with somebody who may be struggling with sexual anorexia, it may be somebody who has perhaps never had sexual contact with other people, or as a result of some sort of trauma, later on, Something may have really traumatized the individual and made them very, very afraid of sexual contact with others. There's often an attitude or a feeling of tremendous shame around sex, the body, sexual behavior, sexual interactions with others, a very puritanical view of sexuality. And of course, I understand, and as we all do, some people have sexual beliefs and sexual, codes of behavior that preclude sometimes some types of sexual behaviors. But I'm talking beyond that, that there's this real sense that something sex is dirty, sex is dangerous, sex is something to be feared, and there's not as much contact with concepts of sexuality as being something that can be very loving and life-affirming and pleasurable to the body and life-sustaining. So people are very phobic and may want to stay away from anything that may lead to some sort of encounter that could lead to sexuality. And somebody doesn't need to be, when we're working with eating disorders, you know, nobody has a hard and fast diagnosis, with whatever we're talking about, whatever type of addiction we're talking about. So we may see somebody who's obese and may not be restricting around food, may in fact be compulsively overeating as a way to keep people away. So there may be sexual anorexia, but what's going on with the food is that too much food is eaten. And sometimes we may see people who are overweight and eating compulsively, where there is compulsive sexuality that kind of lines right up with it. But I do see people often expressing their story, the untold, unarticulated story, through what they do with food and what they do with sexuality. Because after all, when we come into this world, the most basic primitive selves that we come into contact with is through food and very, very basic infant sexuality. And those are things I'm very interested in. And I see people unconsciously really telling us through their behaviors about how this all feels for them.
Well, and it sounds like what you're also saying is, as a clinician, you see the potential relationships between these things. And so you ask the right questions so that they can begin to talk about the parallels in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So
yes, I do. And I also,
anorexia.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. No, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I will also, I've had a number of CSATs, certified sex addiction therapists, interested in my perspective about how to open up their conversations with clients to what they're doing with food. And it's always really fascinating and illuminating for the client and clinician to throw in a question about, what were you eating then? Or what have you had to eat today? You know, if there was a day where somebody had a slip sexually or a relapse or really, really struggled with whether or not they would slip with porn, to say, what was going on that day? What had you eaten that day? And it can just open up this conversation to so much about what was going on with that person because, we are what we eat, right? So what was going on that day? How did we take care of ourselves that day,
And so you just described what sexual anorexia is. Describe what sexual bulimia is.
So kind of following along the same lines, when we're working with somebody who has bulimia with food, there seems to be this very active push and pull. So in food anorexia, there's this rejection of food. In binge eating, and just so all of your listeners know, the changes in our field with the new DSM, Carol, people who are compulsive overeaters and know that about themselves, people can now receive services through their insurance. It's a real, real, real progress in our field. It's a diagnosable illness now, and it has opened up treatment for so many people. I just wanted to say that in case somebody isn't aware of that. With a food anorexic, we see rejection of food. I don't need food. right, with somebody who's compulsive overeating or binge eating, these are people who are turning to food way beyond what their body needs in order to be nourished and healthy. So we have overweight clients or obese clients. The bulimics, both with food and sexuality, are somewhere in the middle. So there's this push and pull around, I want, I need, I can't have, I must get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
So with food we see, and I think there's sometimes a little bit of misinformation and it's hard to understand. Sometimes we see people binging in this traditional way. I think we think of binging in popular culture, you know, large amounts of food, 2 bowls of ice cream, 3 bowls of pasta, 2 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and 2 bowls of cereal. Absolutely, positively, that would describe a binge. It could be something that extreme. But when we talk about binge and purge cycles or eat and purge cycles, it could be that people will eat their dinner and be so disturbed by the fact that they have nurtured themselves with food or fed themselves. In either case, people are purging their food. They can do that through vomiting, which is most common. Also, people will use heavy amounts of laxatives to move food out of their body in the other direction. It's any behavior people engage in to get rid of food or ostensibly get rid of food. And we also have exercise bulimia, where people will use exercise, over-exercise, as a way to kind of rid themselves of food. When we're talking about sexual bulimia, it's that same push and pull. It's the compulsive sexuality, the indiscriminate sex, or whatever it is, whether it's porn usage or, going to, men's clubs or any of these things that would qualify as somebody acting out in their sex addiction, whatever that might be, compulsive masturbation, et cetera. And then there's this response to that where there's this immediate, oh, my gosh, I wish I hadn't done that. That makes me feel very bad about myself. I feel so much shame. I feel so toxic. I need to get rid of this. I need to stop doing this. So we would see something like this in somebody who goes through periods of abstinence, where after a relapse or after a period of acting out sexually, they really go into an abstinence period filled with self-loathing, filled with shame, and filled with just a lot of self-hatred, and we don't see the behavior. It's sort of the getting rid of, right? It's sort of another way of getting rid of the behavior, and then the cycle starts again. It doesn't really go away forever, but there's this, the kind of brakes get put on it.
Well, that makes total sense. Now, as you work with these clients, you
mm-hmm.
tend to work and focus a lot on shame and
mm-hmm.
how shame inhibits
mm-hmm.
people from being able to meet their basic
yeah.
needs. Can
yeah.
you say a little bit more about shame and how it inhibits their basic needs?
Sure. I mean, one of the themes that has come up again and again in the work I do is people's deep sense of shame or a very basic lack of a sense of entitlement just to be full humans with needs, with wants, with hurts, with sorrows, and with desires. And that also feeds into a lot of the work I do. I work with a lot of people. I work with people around issues of shame and hungers and desires. And I think for all of us, it's a real process for us to really be comfortable with our needs, to be comfortable with vulnerability, to be comfortable feeding ourselves in very basic ways. And I think in early recovery, when people really kind of hit a wall and say, I need to do something differently, I often hear, and I'd be interested, Carol, if you do, I often hear stories where there's just so much self-hatred, so much self-loathing, and early stories where either indirectly or through, a lot of abuse or neglect, where people just don't feel entitled to be here. And when people don't feel entitled to take up space on the planet, they walk around with just a basic feeling of badness, a basic feeling of shame, of just who they are. And when that shame is present, I think we start to see the disruption around feeding ourselves at a basic level, and that shows up in food behaviors, and I believe it shows up in sexual behaviors because, you know, we are most aware of ourselves as a body, right? I mean, that's the first awareness we have in the world. You know, before we can meet the gaze of our caretaker is we have this somatic experience of hunger and of touch. And I think there can be a real disruption there if people haven't gotten the message clearly enough that they are inherently valuable and have a right to all of their feelings.
Oh, 100%. You're right. The similarity between the two are amazing and compound the problem but create the same self-loathing and lack of manageability. I mean, they wonder if they're ever going to be able to create behaviors in their life that they feel proud of because this is something they deal with every single day.
Yes, and the other thing that I believe that sexual addiction and sexual issues have in common with eating issues. You cannot use an abstinence model, which is what makes it so complicated. It's about starting, resetting, and creating a healthy relationship. We need to eat and take care of this body every day. And the same is true. I mean, certainly there can be periods of abstinence in recovery, and oftentimes that is what is needed. But ultimately, for somebody to heal from sexual addiction, whatever form it takes, it's not enough just to never be sexual again, right? That's a certain stage of recovery. But ultimately, we want people to be able to feel safe in their bodies and in their sexuality. So it's about learning to relate to oneself and to others, to the world, in a way where there doesn't have to be abuse present.
And so talk about some of the skills that you might utilize with the clients so that they learn that sense of self and that they have the right to meet those needs.
Right. So it's obviously a process, and none of this is overnight, and I'm sure you cautioned your listeners about that, to be patient with the process. You know, a lot of it is exploratory and people really getting to a place where they can be in their process in a strong recovery and really taking a look at the underlying issues. I do a lot of depth work with people and really trying to get them to tell their story and to understand their story, to understand where these behaviors got their start, for me is always the starting point. I very much use the materials in my practice that Patrick Harnes has developed to help people work through their sexual recovery. And for people who are struggling with sexual addiction and eating issues, I also have a program that is able to incorporate that, and that's very specific and obviously has to do with what somebody is actually struggling with and their level of acuity, but it's very, very hands-on the way that, for example, the facing the shadows work is. It's working with a nutritionist. It's being accountable. It's doing food logs. It's learning the process of separating out eating from feelings. It's about really understanding somatic sensation and not responding to that with a compulsive behavior. So it's a lot of work for people who are really struggling, but I do find that in the work I do with most of my clients, no matter where they are, that this is just really important. Nobody, kind of in our culture isn't affected. The things that are going on in our culture around sex and food, which are in our face all the time, you know, it's really doing that check-in about how do I take care of myself? How do I go about my day being authentic and understanding what my emotions are, what my body is feeling, and how to feed myself without overdoing it or underdoing it. It's a lot about balance. So it's the psychological piece. It's the process piece, the dynamic work between therapist and client. It's doing the homework. It's step-by-step through the activities. It's working with the nutritionist. It's starting to move if you're not moving your body in a healthy way. It's exercising less if you're using exercise to escape. And, you know, that's a lot of this, too. People, both in sexual addiction and in eating disorders, are escaping themselves through these behaviors. So it's about learning to be present. I mean, I think at the end of the day, all of the work we do with clients is a trying to separate from the behaviors enough to be present with themselves.
Well, absolutely.
And to develop
and
that relationship with the self.
Exactly. And so you really help people to identify what they're feeling, because that is one of the basic links to helping somebody get real with themselves, and then to create strategies that will get some of those basic needs met.
Yeah, and sometimes it's, you know, it has to, we have to flip-flop it and start the other way. Sometimes clients will come to me with such out-of-control behaviors that it's not the time to try to figure out so much about what one is feeling, but it's about decreasing the behaviors enough to be safe. And we know that in sexual addiction, people can be, you know, at the height of their addiction, very unsafe and in danger, and we want to reduce those behaviors kind of and then do some of the work, the deeper work, and certainly with eating disorders. We need to really help people be safe in their bodies, because eating disorders continue to unfortunately rank among the most lethal of all of the mental disorders. You know, people are dying from eating disorders, so sometimes we really just need to get somebody to a point where they can do the work.
Oh, 100%. And that is why the two combined, a sexual addiction, anorexia, bulimia, whatever, combined with an eating disorder is absolutely toxic, can be fatal. Now, I just want to remind people who are listening to you, I'm speaking with, and Deborah, would you tell me, it's Deborah Schweiger.
Schweiger Whalen. You said it perfectly.
Okay,
when you announced it, you did a great job.
Well, excellent, because that is a handful. But I want to tell you that
it is
spelled S-C-H-W-E-I-G-E-R-W-H-A-L-E-N if you want to Google her. Or she has this website. Tell them your website.
It's another mouthful. My website is www.zephyrusofsantafe.com, and I will spell it www.zephyrusofsantafe.com. Zephyrus of Santa Fe, Zephyrus.
Excellent. And Zephyrus is what, Deborah?
Zephyrus is the god of the west wind. And in Greek mythology, he is the interceder between the world of the living and the underworld. So I think that's a lot of the work we do, is to come out of the shadows, as Patrick Harnes would say, right? And then to really come back to life, not by disavowing our darkness, but by inviting it in and being compassionate with it, to understand it.
Well, and I think if anybody's listening to you right now, they can tell that you're very compassionate, that you really understand the normal plight that can occur whenever you have deep trauma wounds that you have medicated through sex or the lack thereof, through food or the lack thereof. Yeah. And one can get a hold of you by calling 505-820-0477. That is your telephone number. Or they can contact you at info@zephyrusofsantafe.com. And again, that's Z-E-P-H-R-U-S-O-F.
Y-R-U-S.
Oh, thank you very much. P-H-Y-R-U-S. YRUSOFSANTAFE.com.
Thank you.
Now, you're welcome. You have really made it your mission to work with people based on these two disorders specifically, although you have a wide range of clinical knowledge and a variety of things, certainly almost any type of sexual addiction. Can you explain a little bit about your reference that you made in your article to wounded communication? You know, you talk about disordered behavior as unique language requiring decoding in that therapeutic process. So tell our listeners a little bit about what is wounded communication.
You know, I was developing a presentation at one point, and I wanted to stress that I really believe we are always in a process, all of us, of communicating. There's nothing we do that isn't a communication in some way. Sometimes we're aware of it, and sometimes we're unaware. But this capacity, this innate capacity for humans to communicate is one of the things I think we're just, you know, gifted with, endowed with to be doing all the time. I really believe that these behaviors, these addictive, compulsive, ultimately self-defeating behaviors are there because of a lack of other positive tools or skills that people have. So when I'm meeting with people who are struggling with these behaviors, I'm really, really trying to understand what it is they are communicating to me and to the rest of the world by what they are doing with their bodies and with food. So I'm really, really looking for their personal, unique communication system, and this is what I refer to as wounded communication. It's an expression of the wounding, of the pain, and the trauma. And I think that my role, first and foremost, is to be present and to be listening for what cannot yet be put into words. And that's, you know, that's trauma work. That's the trauma work we do with people, is we bring their symptoms from a place of being acted out into a place where they can be articulated and not overwhelm the individual, because it's the state of being overwhelmed with feeling that the person is just not prepared to deal with. In my opinion, that's where these symptoms come from. It's a state of overwhelm, and it's an expression of wounded.
Well, absolutely, and it sounds like you're a mind reader, but what you typically know when you hear what the issues are is this wounded communication really means that people haven't identified yet what has traumatized them, and so you help them dig deep to figure out what that is.
Yes, and you know, with all forms of self-harm, that's the way I think about it. You know, what is the purpose of this? Human beings rarely do things that are not purposeful. It's just who we are. And what is the function of this? What is the meaning of this? It's never random. You know, whether a client in my office bulimic or anorexic, it's never random or haphazard. That individual was drawn to this kind of behavior because the story they need to tell is in that behavior. And it's honoring it. And I try to model that for my clients. We must first honor what you've done to get here into this office, because you may not have survived without it. I am quite sure that the vast majority of clients I have worked with, if they hadn't had their self-defeating behaviors to steady them, that they wouldn't have made it, that this is survival. This is the best they could do, and it needs to be honored before it can be let go.
Oh, 100%. And so obviously with you going into it and excavating based on the fact that you have to honor that, that it was really a coping mechanism. It may have medicated the pain.
Yeah.
It may have helped them deal with the pain.
Right.
It
right.
then requires that you normalize it and make different choices. Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
So now,
right.
Well, let me ask you, what kind of treatment is available to our listeners who may have listened to you and said, oh, my gosh, she's speaking my song. I mean, I know I have issues with eating. I know I have issues with sex. Where do I go next?
It's a very complex question, Carol. It really is, and I'm sure you know that probably better than me. That requires a little bit of research. To my knowledge, it is fairly difficult to find treatment that really, really works on the overlap. However, I think that there is more and more information available, and that as people are seeking out therapists, are seeking out programs, that at the very least they can ask the questions. They can ask about, you know, is it possible for me to get help with both of these issues? I know I'm a sex addict. I also struggle with food. And that may be a starting point. I think that there's a way to go in our field around more and more programs actually really, really working on fused addictions at the same time. So a lot of the work I do is to try to bring this issue to the attention of professionals who I think inherently get it. But I think as a field, Carol, I don't know if you agree, I think we're just really starting to be able to put it all together. It's a challenging question. People can always contact me, and I will give them any resource I can. I certainly know of some professionals around the country and some programs that are really, really looking very closely at this. You know, there's the ranch in Tennessee that works with eating disorders and sexual addiction, and I work closely here in Santa Fe. My eating disorder IOP is working very closely with a behavioral health intensive outpatient program here, and I bridge the gap with the sexual addiction piece and with the eating disorder piece. And, you know, what we're finding is that it works very, very well, because just to treat the eating disorder or just to treat the sex addiction or just to treat the depression or anxiety and to treat these things separately is not as beneficial as if we can kind of put it together and pool our resources and treat the whole person. So I'm really hopeful that that's where this field is going. But it's a challenging question right now. But your listeners can always get in touch, and, you know, either through you or directly to me, and I will give them any resources I have for this issue.
Do you work at all with Remuda, which I know is part of the Meadows right now?
No, I haven't worked so much with them recently, so I know there's been a lot of changes there, but that also is very, very hopeful because, of course, the Meadows has the long history of doing phenomenal work around sexual addiction and then all of the expertise of Remuda with eating disorders. So I think that's a very, very hopeful union, you know, with respect to the kinds of treatment that I'd like to advocate for.
Absolutely. Well, let's go over one more time your contact information so people can contact you if they need to. And obviously, the way you said that, you're really available as a resource guide for anybody who listens to this podcast. And the phenomenal thing about this podcast is that people access it for months thereafter through iTunes, and of course, we've got this listed as a podcast on sexual addiction and eating disorders. So they can contact you either by calling you at 505-820-0477, or they can go to your website and go ahead and state the website and then spell it.
Zephyrus of Santa Fe, www.zephyrusofsanta.com. And my email address is info@zephyrusofsantafe, zephyrusofsanta.com.
And certainly, Deborah, you know, the paper that you wrote specifically on eating disorders and sexual addiction, it was for a conference, if I'm not mistaken, for gay and lesbian groups. And so,
I have done a presentation like that. The article that I sent to you, Carol, was published. Yeah, the NIDA article. It was published in a quarterly magazine of the National Eating Disorder Association's a magazine they put out with the various articles, and I believe the issue was devoted to diversity, and I wrote an article about sexual addiction and eating disorders specifically in the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and questioning community, and there's a huge vulnerability there because of the institutionalized and cultural shaming of that group, and how I have observed in my practice, and lots of research is being done on how we can very often see a great deal of pain in the area of food and sex in that group.
Well, I know that you write a lot and you teach a lot about toxic shame, and that would make sense that this is a population that experiences toxic shame anyway because of our societal values. So I so appreciate that this population may have special difficulty with this, but your discussion tonight was for anybody, men or women, who have toxic shame and also experience issues around sexual addiction, sexual anorexia, sexual bulimia, and eating disorders of any type. So, Deborah, I want to thank you again for putting this out there. You know, it's one thing to have to deal with the shame of an eating disorder and coupled with sexual addiction. Sometimes it's too much to be able to talk to and talk about in a therapist's office. So you would encourage anybody to talk with their therapist in detail about these issues.
Carol, I can't stress enough, if there's anything the listeners of your show this evening take away from this, is everything you're experiencing is essential and vital. And I can't tell you how many times I have worked with people who are in full, fantastic, many years recovery from sex addiction, from alcohol addiction, from drug addiction, who really, really are struggling with food issues. And because they've overcome some of these other issues, and that was such a challenge, and perhaps the right person hasn't asked the right question at the right time, but I have seen so many people, even in good recovery, basing their self-worth on the number on a scale or how many calories they've eaten or how long they've been at the gym that day. And we've normalized that, Carol, as a culture, right? We laud it. We think that's wonderful when people are obsessed with their bodies, et cetera. And to me, that's another prison. Counting calories, counting fat, feeling fat all the time, hating your body, that is not an okay way to live. If you compare it in the bottle or being addicted to heroin, you still deserve help with that too.
Well, and it's, of course, when we look externally for validation based on externally what we're doing, we're setting ourselves up for failure. So, Deborah, thank you so much for sharing
your information tonight. Thank you so much, Carol.
And I look forward to seeing you at the symposium later this month.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. Have a wonderful evening, and it's been a pleasure. Thanks again.
All right. You have a great week. And
bye-bye.
For all my listeners out there, we've got about 30 seconds, but I do want to encourage you to go to her website. Again, that's thefeastofsantafe.com. And as I tell you every week, there'll only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. We'll see you next week. Have a good one.